I would like, in my reflections on the situation of patristic studies, to reflect first of all on three success stories. The first success story is the event we are celebrating today, the 500th volume in Sources Chrétiennes. At its foundation in 1942, the series Sources Chrétiennes aimed, I think, to make the Fathers available to a wider public beyond the narrow circle of academic specialists. And so initially, the first volumes in Sources Chrétiennes had only a French translation with a restricted quantity of notes. But that very quickly changed. And soon texts appeared with the original in Greek or Latin, often a critical edition with full introduction, scholarly apparatus. And in many instances, texts were included that had not been available, except perhaps in paraphrase, such as most of the works of St. Simeon, the new theologian. I note how in Sources Chrétiennes there was sometimes a collaboration of Catholics and Orthodox. For example, in the case of Archbishop Basil Krivoshein, he worked with Father Paramel. And I remember Archbishop Basil saying to me, "The translation is by a Jesuit, but it is very good." I noticed the word "but." The continuing success of Sources Chrétiennes shows that there is a public seriously interested in patristic writings. That's one success story. And now another success story. The influence of the Philokalia, which broadly speaking is a collection of patristic writings, during the past 50 years. The editors of the Philokalia, St. Macarius of Corinth, St. Nicodemus of the Holy Mountain, insist that the Philokalia is a book for all Christians. Iskinin ton orthodoxon ophelian, it says on the title page, for the general benefit of the Orthodox. In his preface, St. Nicodemus affirms unambiguously that the book is addressed to all who share the Orthodox calling, laity and monks alike. And in particular, St. Nicodemus maintains that the Pauline injunction, "Pray without ceasing," 1 Thessalonians 5:17, is intended not just for hermits in caves and on mountaintops, but for married Christians with responsibilities for a family, for farmers, merchants, and lawyers, even, he says, for kings and courtiers living in palaces. The command to pray without ceasing is a universal command in the view of the editors of the Philokalia. The best is for everyone. However, the Philokalia was not immediately a very popular book in the Greek world. The first edition came out in 1782. We have to wait 113 years before there is a second edition. And then we have to wait another 64 years before the third edition comes out after the Second World War. So in the Greek world, the Philokalia was not exactly a bestseller. The Slav world, of course, there's a rather different history. In the 19th century, the Philokalia was reprinted a number of times in the Slavonic translation of St. Paisy Velichkovsky and later in the Russian translation of St. Theophan Zatvornik. Even so, the influence of the Dobrotolubie was limited on the whole to certain monasteries. Insofar as it was read by the laity, it would just have been read by the lay people who frequented those monasteries. In the West, the Philokalia was almost totally unknown. It's very interesting that the editors of the Greek Patrology of Mene only had access to the Greek Philokalia from volume 85 onwards. Until then, the learned Dom Petra and his assistants didn't know about the Philokalia. They refer to it as ex libro inter rariores rarissimo, extremely rare among rare books. Since the Second World War, however, exactly in the period in which the collection Source Chrétien rose to wide diffusion, the story of the Philokalia has become completely different. There's been a truly astonishing expansion in its influence. First of all, from 1946 onwards, there is the Romanian translation, edited by Father Dimitri Stanilaue. And the roots of that are to be found in the monastery of Optina. It was a monk who had been a disciple of the Optina fathers, a Father Ioan, who came to Romania after the Second World War and aroused an interest among the members of the Brotherhood of the Burning Bush in the Hesychast tradition. I had a very interesting conversation about that with Father Sofian of the Antim Monastery, and he told me how important this Russian link had been for the young theologians of the post-war Romanian church. But also, quite unexpectedly, the Philokalia becomes profoundly influential in Western Europe. Here, I think, a pioneering role is played by Great Britain. In the 1950s, a selection of material translated from the Russian Dobrotolubie of St. Theophan appeared under the editorship of the Russian Orthodox Evgenia Kadlubovsky and the English Orthodox Gerald Palmer. And there is an interesting story about their two-volume translation of the Philokalia. They sent it to the English publishers Faber and Faber. And the different members of the firm looked at this manuscript. Perhaps it has a certain interest, they said, but we could not possibly publish it. There would be no commercial interest in such books. However, there was one director of Faber and Faber who was of a different opinion, and that was the poet T.S. Eliot. And he said, "This is a work of such remarkable importance We should publish it even if we lose a lot of money. So it was accepted. And those two volumes, published in 1951 and 1954, are still in print today. I think the first volume has been reprinted 17 times. And Faber said to me, one of their staff recently, "We have never lost money on an Orthodox book." So, this story illustrates the words of Christ: "Seek first the kingdom of heaven, and everything else will be given you as well." Then you have, of course, the French translation of the Philokalia from 1979 onwards, by Bellefontaine, reissued by Desclée de Brouwer in 1995. You have translations of the Philokalia in Italian, Finnish, German, Arabic. There have been at least two translations of the whole of the Philokalia into modern Greek. So the true era of the Philokalia has not been the time of the movement of the Collivades on Mount Athos in the late 18th century. Nor has it been Holy Russia in the 19th century. The true era of the Philokalia has been the late 20th century, the secularized, postmodernist, post-Enlightenment era. Today, the Philokalia has come into its own. So we could see the Philokalia as a kind of spiritual time bomb. It was prepared in the late 18th century for Greek Orthodox under the Turcocratia, but it has come into its own today. I'm sure this brings great happiness to St. Macarius and St. Nicodemus. And once more, we have here clear evidence that the voice of the fathers speaks with eloquence and power to our own epoch. A third success story, to which reference has already been made at this conference, is the Oxford Patristic Conference, convened by Dr. F. L. Cross. I think the first such conference was 1951. It's held every 4 years. It will meet again next year, 2007. The recent meetings of the Patristic Conference have been oversubscribed. Eminent applicants have to be turned away because we do not have room for everybody who wants to come, even though we have 600 or 700 people coming to this conference. So if you want to participate in the 2007 conference, enroll at once, or it may be too late. I think of a story in the Gerontikon, in the Sayings of the Desert Fathers: "There is a voice which speaks to everyone until their last day. And this voice says, today." So enroll today if you want to go. There are some success stories. Yet alas, as we contemplate the actuality of patristic studies, we cannot speak only of success. And here I would like to refer to an article written recently by an Orthodox patristic scholar, Father Andrew Louth, who is professor of patristics at the University of Durham, who is, I think, the most eminent patristic scholar in the English language anywhere in the world in any church. In the journal Suraj for last year, 2005, He wrote an article called 25 Years of Patristic Studies. Here he notes a strange paradox. He says, at the beginning, patristic study is livelier than ever. Yet, he continues, if we look at the situation in English universities, we have to admit that in the faculties of theology and religious studies, patristic work seems set for, and I quote his words, irrevocable decline. And I think in many other places apart from England, so far as universities go, patristic studies are threatened. Let me just illustrate this from my own experience in Oxford. I commenced teaching Eastern Orthodox studies at Oxford in 1966. My position was a special lectureship, the Spalding Lectureship. There were, at that time, seven regular professorial chairs in the university. Now there are eight. In 1966, three of those chairs were held by eminent patristic scholars: Henry Chadwick, F.L. Cross, and S.L. Greenslade. Today, among the eight regular professors in Oxford, there is not a single patristic scholar among them. Oxford, one of the universities in the past, which was always a centre for patristic studies, no person with a senior post has any interest in the fathers. Liberal theology, modern liberal theology, reigns supreme. And of course, here I speak as an Orthodox. In Orthodox context, as you will know very well, the word liberal is not a compliment. We do have in the Oxford theology faculty two fairly junior posts in patristics. One of them is only temporary, and interestingly, it is financed with Orthodox money. In my 35 years as Spalding lecturer, I had no lack of gifted students at the doctoral level. With a certain modest pride, I hope I may say that, yes, over 35 of my students successfully completed the doctorate. And I don't think anyone else in the Oxford Theology faculty can claim a record equal to that. And during my later years, I certainly had more doctoral students than any of the regular professors. So there was no lack of gifted students. I recall the Jewish proverb, "Happy is the teacher who has pupils more gifted than he is." And I had that happiness many times. I can think among my pupils of recent years, Bishop Hilarion Alfeev of Vienna, and Father John Baer, who has just recently been appointed Dean of St. Vladimir's Seminary in New York, in the footsteps of Father Alexander Schmemann and Father John Meyendorf, both alumni of Saint-Serge. Yet, in spite of the interest shown in my area of studies, the university has appointed no successor to myself. They are not interested in the Christian East. That seems to them irrelevant and marginal. So that is the reality by which we are faced. If patristic studies are to survive in English universities and elsewhere, then we must suffer and struggle to ensure that survival. The present situation is one of opportunity, but also of challenge. I hope that we shall at least see a revival of patristic studies in the Orthodox world, with the fall of communism in Eastern Europe. Surely there could be a real renewal of patristic studies in Russia, in other Eastern European countries. In Romania there are already good patristic scholars. So a success story, but also patristic studies is, in ecological terms, an endangered species. What of the future? What should be the future spirit of our patristic studies? I am convinced, and here I return to the first of the lectures that we heard this morning of Father Iov, I am convinced that the program indicated by Father George Florovsky is still valid. The program, often described as neo-patristic synthesis. I think, for example, of an article such as we find in the first volume of his collected writings in English, St. Gregory Palamas and the Tradition of the Fathers, written some 50 years ago. But his program was already to be found 20 years earlier than that in his address at the Athens Congress of Orthodox Theology in 1936. I believe his words are as timely today as when they were first spoken. His program is summed up in the phrase, following the Holy Fathers. I quote, following the Holy Fathers. It was usual in the ancient church to introduce doctrinal statements by phrases like this. The decree of Chalcedon opens precisely with these very words. The Seventh Ecumenical Council introduces its decision concerning the holy icons in a more elaborate way. Following the divinely inspired teaching of the Holy Fathers and the tradition of the Catholic Church. The didaskalia of the Fathers, says Father George, is the formal and normative term of reference. And he continues, the Church is equally committed to the kerygma of the Apostles and to the dogma of the Fathers. The Church is apostolic indeed, but the Church is also patristic. She is intrinsically the Church of the Fathers. These two notes cannot be separated. Only by being patristic is the Church truly apostolic. But then he goes on to qualify this. He says, this is much more than just an appeal to antiquity. The witness of the Fathers is much more than simply a historic feature, a voice from the past. So, Father George insists, we are to treat the Fathers as living witnesses, as our contemporaries. We should not ask just, what did the Fathers say 1500 years ago? We should ask, what would they say if they were living today, if they were confronted by our present day hopes and fears? In this context, he quotes St. Cyprian. Antiquitas sine veritate vetustas erroris est. Antiquity without truth is merely long-established error. So what matters about the fathers is not their antiquity, but their truth. Old customs, says Father George, as such, do not guarantee the truth. Truth is not just a habit. So, he is against a theology of repetition. We are not just to say the same things as always were said in the past. Orthodox bishops have to remind themselves that the symbol of a bishop is a double-headed eagle, not a double-headed parrot. Though you would not always guess that when listening to them. It is not enough merely to cite the words of the fathers accurately. We do not want merely a patristic fundamentalism. What is needed, says Father George, is to enter into the mind of the fathers, their phronema. We are to seek the fundamental coherence and spirit of the fathers. And Father George is willing to say that one of the chief characteristics of this patristic phronema is that their theology is existential, a word that people are sometimes criticized for using, but he's willing to use it with some qualifications. He says, if we may use this current neologism, existential. And he developed this by quoting St. Gregory of Nazianzus, that we are to theologize in the manner of the apostles, not in that of Aristotle. Halieftikos, in the manner of the fishermen. Ouk Aristotelikos. This means theology is a message, a kerygma. It does not involve only exact historical study, though this is certainly required, but theology involves also, I use his words, commitment and engagement. The ultimate reference, he says, is to the vision of faith, to spiritual knowledge and experience. So note the words he's using here, vision and experience. In that sense, theology is not just a science. More specifically, to possess a patristic mind, according to Father George, is to insist upon the indissoluble link between theology and prayer. And that's something that has come up more than once today. For example, Father Jove, when speaking of Father Kyprian Kern, insisted on the link for Father Kyprian between liturgy and patrology. As Father George says, patristic theology could be only preached or proclaimed, preached from the pulpit, proclaimed also in the words of prayer and in the sacred rites. Theology can never be separated from the life of prayer and from the exercise of virtue. The climax of purity is the beginning of theology, as St. John Climacus puts it. Telos tis agnias hypothesis theologias. That's from the final chapter of the Ladder of Divine Ascent. This calls to my mind what St. Gregory Palamas said about theologians. There are, he says, three kinds of theologian. The real theologians are the saints, those who know the divine realm not by hearsay, but through personal experience, those who have received the vision of God. Then secondly, he says, there are others who perhaps are not saints, and would not claim to have received the direct vision of God, but they trust the saints. And if you trust the saints, you can also be a true theologian, though on a secondary level. Then thirdly, says Palamas, there are those who lack direct experience of the divine realm and who do not trust the saints. And they are bad theologians. That, I think, gives a place for theology in university faculties. Even if we are not all saints, perhaps we can trust the saints and interpret what the saints say to our pupils. We all know the famous saying of Evagrius of Pontus, the theologian is the one who prays, and if you pray in truth, you are a theologian. That was exactly the way Father George Florovsky understood the patristic mind. And it is also the approach, as we know, of Vladimir Losky. The beginning of his work on the mystical theology of the Eastern Church, he says, far from being mutually opposed, theology and mysticism support and complete each other. One is impossible without the other. And it's worth remembering that Losky gave the best years of his life to the study of a mystical theologian, indeed, a Western mystical theologian, Meister Eckhart. I think for every 100 people who've read the mystical theology of the Eastern Church, it would be difficult to find even one who has read from beginning to end Losky's great work on Meister Eckhart. And the Eckhartian specialists tell me that this is still one of the key works in this field. So it's interesting how Losky studied a mystical theologian and indeed a Western mystical theologian. Losky hoped to complete his work, tripartite work, by writing a comparative volume between 14th century Western mystical theology and 14th century Palamite theology, but he never lived to carry out that task, and no one else has really undertaken it since. I might say I've read most of the book on Meister Eckhart, but I did skip some of the footnotes. The same approach as we find in Father George Florovsky, in Vladimir Losky and Father Kyprian Kern, we can see, for example, also in the Greek thinker Christos Yanaras. Theology, he says, is not an intellectual discipline, but an experiential communion, a participation. I noted how Professor Stavrou, in his talk, used exactly those words, communion, participation. In other words, theology, according to the mind of the fathers, is not just an academic discipline based on the reasoning brain, though we have to use our reasoning brain, but it is, says Janaras, also the fruit of the interior purity of the Christian's spiritual life. Theology, he writes, in terms that recall Palamas, is to be identified with the vision of God, with the personal experience of the transfiguration of creation by uncreated grace. If our patristic studies are undertaken in the spirit indicated by Florovsky, Losky, Kern and Janaras, then surely we may be confident that patristics has not only a past, but a future. The voice of the fathers can and should be heard today as a contemporary voice of startling relevance and piercing urgency. Thank you.